Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. For those of you who are just joining us, we're going to spend the first half of this hour or so talking with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. He's our regular guest when we do a religion roundup, usually on about a weekly basis. He's the watcher of things religious for United Press International. He'll join us here in just a moment. Then we have open lines for an hour from 4:30 to 5:30. What are we going to be talking about during open lines? I said we were going to talk about something I'm calling ecclesiastical Darwinism. Now, this is neither evolution in terms of origin of the species or some odd strain of theology. You'll find out during open lines what ecclesiastical Darwinism is. I might even ask you to guess what I'm talking about when I talk about ecclesiastical Darwinism. Also, some other news to share with you during open lines to bring you up to date on an Ohio amendment. No, not an Ohio amendment, an Ohio law, 38th state with the law banning same-sex marriage. And we'll be talking about that in part a little later with Josh Baker, policy analyst for the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy based in Washington, D.C., about that, about the federal marriage amendment and about Bush's marriage initiative. That'll round off the 3 hours of Issues Etc. today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. Uwe, welcome back.
Thanks to be back.
I want to begin with a column that you wrote, a commentary reacting to a recent 60 Minutes Sunday night program on evangelicals. What was your general reaction? What was the reaction of evangelicals, you know?
Well, it did not portray the evangelicals that I know, because, I mean, obviously, evangelicals being so important in this country, I tend to spend a lot of time watching them, and they are a very diverse group, as we all know, ranging from the Billy Graham form of evangelicalism to very hard, politically very hard, tough conservatives to fundamentalists, who believe that the tribulations, or that the hereafter is going to start right now, and Christ is coming around the corner, and we, the children and those of us who are believers, will be whisked away, and others won't. And what got me so angered when I saw this piece by Morley Safer on 60 Minutes was the shoddy research they've done. Because Safer made all evangelicals look like the ones who believe in the immediate rapture, the impending rapture, and that, you know, when Morley Safer interviewed one of their pastors, the pastor more or less told Safer, who was Jewish, that he was damned and he would experience terrible things. And this, to me, is very untheological, and I'm surprised that a guy as experienced a journalist as Morley Safer shouldn't have dug a little more deeply into the matter.
So, in other words, your critique really lies in the fact that while there are certainly things to be questioned about evangelicalism, some of its manifestations, the 60 Minutes piece simply didn't get into what a broad spectrum evangelicalism is, from good to bad to ugly.
Well, precisely, and that is bad-mouthing and a very substantial segment of the American population, and indeed of the world's population. It bad-mouths, in a sense, me. I wouldn't consider myself evangelical in the 21st century sense, but more in the 16th century sense. But that is another matter. But I mean, I also obviously believe that the only way to salvation is through Christ. But we leave it there, and we don't then say, well, you know, you, because you're being Jewish, you have to just expect to burn in hell, when we don't know whether or not Morley Safer is going to encounter Christ at the moment of death, and indeed maybe beyond. What do we know? I mean, this is self-righteousness, which is, of course, contrary to the gospel, and it is not my type of Christianity, and I think that those evangelicals who say that are in error. But that is not even the issue of my story. The issue of my story is that Morley Safer was broad brushing about one third of the American population, and making them all, whether they want or not, look like what is called dispensationalists, which is one very specific form of evangelicalism that comes out of Dallas, and it actually comes out of the 19th century.
My main concern, Uwe, and we talk an awful lot about evangelicals
right.
here, I try to be careful to say many evangelicals rather than evangelicals in general, so that I avoid the broad brush. But my main concern with evangelicalism is kind of what I would say the Christian bookstore phenomenon, where you do find some of the manifestations of the faddism, as you said, the dispensationalism, the conspiracy type of ideas. And then just the kind of general lack of theological depth, a mile wide, an inch deep. That's my main concern, kind of the popular front for evangelicalism and its control of the Christian media, radio, television, and publishing.
Todd, I fully agree with you. But, I mean, you know, if you look at Christianity Today, for example, you'll get some very pretty profound theology there. And, I'm talking daily to evangelicals of various denominations. I mean, one of my best interlocutors is an evangelical Episcopalian, whose theology I greatly respect, even though it may not necessarily correspond to my theology, but at least, you know, there is some something very profound there. And, of course, what people like Morley Safer have totally are totally ignoring, and I think that's damnable considering the experience this guy has, and the money is paid for it, is that in evangelicalism there has been a great deal of scholarship lately, ever since this book came out, you know, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, I think Mark Knoll, and you look at various seminaries, evangelical seminaries, and you find very, very good theological scholarship. It may not be ours, but it's still good. And to then say, well, all evangelicals, all 60, 80, 100 millions of them, or what are sort of guys who watch these funny films and believe this to be gospel truth, or who read these funny books and believe them to be gospel truth, that is actually just bad-mouthing. And I would definitely expect my money back from watching this thing. I mean, I got very angry, and I knew the guy from Vietnam. I got very, very angry with that.
In that vein, folks, I would recommend a book by Daryl Hart. It's just been published, called Deconstructing Evangelicalism, where he tracks the scholarship that evangelicalism has been producing, and in particular with an eye toward identifying what evangelicalism is, what it has become. The book is called Deconstructing Evangelicalism. I think it's Conservative Protestantism in the Age of Billy Graham, and it's a tremendous work. We just interviewed him several weeks ago. Uwe, you've also written about something, and this strikes me as ironic. You begin this column, Path to Rome, a Trend, by saying every year the Roman Catholic Church grows by 10 million worldwide. Those are staggering numbers. We're talking about how many Roman Catholics worldwide now, total?
It's about 1.1 billion almost.
And yet they're racked with scandal, at least in America, over the last two and a half years.
What
accounts for this?
Well, what accounts for it is, one, of course, is simply biology, you see. I mean, it's the biological factor. The Catholics are very strong in the southern hemisphere, and of course they have lots of children, and so they grow biologically. But there are hundreds of thousands of Protestants. Well, in this country alone, I think it's about 175,000 who convert on any given Easter night to Catholicism, plus 75,000 people who are being baptized at night. The former, of course, are Christians of other denominations. The latter would be non-Christians, like, you know, Judge Bork, for example, and all sorts of others who convert there. And then, of course, you have this the same sort of thing going on in Europe, where Protestants become Catholics and more so. And the reason is really that for whatever theological theological differences one might have with the Roman Catholic Church, at least it stands up for its beliefs. I mean, the scandals that we experience here in the United States are not worldwide. I mean, you know, there is a vibrant Catholic, actually evangelical Catholic Church growing in Africa and in South America and other places. On the one issue which I think, this is going back to a previous interview we've had, one issue which I think is the most pressing issue worldwide right now, and that is the confrontation between Christianity and Islam, especially in Europe, less so in the United States, but here as well, but in Europe and in, around the rims of Europe, there the Roman Catholics, the Catholic Church, has a much straighter and much wiser policy than most Protestant denominations, because most Protestant denominations, at least mainline, are either politically correct and, or they don't see it, or they suck up to the Muslims, or they are so wrapped up in their own problems, whereas the Roman Catholic Church, especially in Europe, and that I've researched now very deeply over the last few months, has a clear policy in place, which is what people recognize. And actually, the Catholics are imploring, say, the German Lutherans and what have you, please join us in this endeavor. We've got to be prepared for this influx of Muslims from Turkey and North Africa and what have you. And we're open to dialogue and persevere here. And, of course, this is not generally the case. And most people, those who convert, and many of the people that I know of who are converts, point to this, saying at least the Roman Catholic Church follows a very clear line on issues like that. Also on morality, homosexuality, abortion, all these things, which many mainline Protestant churches water down to their own disgrace.
You also write, why is this evident weakness in the traditional Protestant churches? Evidently because of the relentless pursuit of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age.
Yeah.
Are we watching an exodus from Protestantism and general growth of the Roman Catholic Church because Protestantism has become, in some sectors, theologically bankrupt and compromised with the culture?
Well, precisely, theologically bankrupt and cowardly and unfaithful. And if you think, for example, that in this country alone, according to the latest Barna report, you might quibble with him over some figures, but 28%, only 28% of the Protestant, mainline Protestant pastors affirm the basic tenets of the Christian faith. The omniscience and omnipotence of God, the divinity of Christ, the virgin birth, you name it. All these things that our parents obviously took for granted as basic Christian beliefs, only 28% of the mainline Protestant pastors, only 15% of the women pastors do it, in this country. Well, If the zeitgeist, if what dictates the fads out there in the street dominates the minds of these people, why bother? Why bother going to church? Why would I want to go to church to listen to the same garbage that I see on television every morning? So therefore, the Roman Catholic Church obviously is much more solid. You know, there are other churches, good Protestant churches, ours, for example, that fall in the same line as the Roman Catholic Church. But, I mean, the fault does not lie with... You know, I went in Germany, I had a major argument with a friend of mine, who was a former Lutheran bishop, over what he called the incident attempt by the Roman Catholics to evangelize Eastern Germany. Well, why do they evangelize the land of Luther? Because the others are not doing the job. The others quibble about, I don't know, things they don't know anything about, like Iraq. And the Romans go in, and they have a 50-year plan. They say, maybe we're not going to succeed this generation, maybe not in the next, but in the one after that, we'll be there. And if the and the guy then said, obviously, East Germany or the land of Luther will in 50 years' time be Roman Catholic if it's not going to be Muslim. Well, he has a point, but I mean, it is. Don't blame the Catholics for it. I mean, Matthew 28 applies to the Catholics as much as to us. And so, if they are, we are not doing a job, and they are doing a job, then so much the better for them.
Another subject you've written about, Uwe, is the amazing fact that against what seems to have been a trend for, one might argue, in fact, I think it is Leon Pottles in a book called, I can't believe I've forgotten the name of the book. It'll come back to me in just a second. The Church Impotent.
Yeah.
He argues a thousand-year trend of the feminization of Christianity. You are finding that men are returning to European churches. Why?
To some. I mean, one has to be qualified. To some. Why? For the same reason. Now that the society is feminized and you you have women going to combat, leaving their three children behind in the hands of a chubby husband who then has to feed them Coca-Cola rather than milk or God knows what, then, of course, you have a reversal. Now, then, of course, suddenly the men reflect on the emptiness they experience, and so therefore they're going back to, in some areas of Europe, going back to church. Leipzig is a prime example. I know a few others. And, of course, then there are singles. Men who have been really emasculated in many parts of Western Europe and in the United States find themselves lonely. And so they go to church and they find a family there. And this is, I know, one large cathedral congregation in Germany whose pastor told me about this particular phenomenon there. Which, in a sense, I suppose, is a blessing, a great blessing, because, I mean, here you can really evangelize among the one sex that that refused to be evangelized. And, you know, they used to go to church even in my childhood, stand at the back of the church and during a sermon slip out and have a tipple across the road in the local tavern and then come back for communion or for the benediction. That seems to be, there seems to be a chance here that this is changing. But, I mean, the gender war and the destruction of the loving relationship between man and woman by the feminist movement is, in some instances, not globally, but in some instances leading to a return of the men, of the lonely, scared, disenfranchised men to church, to the church, finding a new family there.
Uwe Simonetto is our guest. It's our religion roundup for the next few minutes of Issues Etc. He's religion editor for United Press International. Feel free to join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Going to the phones, Harold is calling from St. Charles. Harold, welcome.
Yes, Uwe, I hear you when you say about how the Roman Church is taking somewhat of a strong stand against the Muslims. But then I hear some contrary things, like the Pope, you know, he says, oh, we all believe in the same God. And then another report was that he goes and kisses the Quran, and every once in a while some of these other things you're wondering, well what's Rome up to? And then, too, about, you know, like some of the Elka people over in this country, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, a number of their clergy, and I suppose that's the case there in Europe, too, where they're joining the Roman Church. But we had an incident there with Elka clergyman I asked him at a meeting at Concordia Seminary. We had a paper lecture. I says, what's your view on women's ordination? He says, I am more and more in favor than ever for women's ordination because I had a wonderful woman vicar. And so what happened? I asked my brother, professor, where's this fellow now? He says he went and joined Rome. But, what happens when these fellows, when they join the Roman Church and they're asked about their views on women's ordination there, and they say, well, I've been in favor of it. What do they say? Well, the only big question is, do you recognize the Bishop of Rome as the supreme pontiff, the head of the church in the world.
Harold, thanks for the call. Yeah. Your response to the several things he laid out there, Uwe?
Well, let's say this. I can only refer to the not to the personal things that Harold said, but he has a legitimate question. Why is the Pope doing this? Well, the Pope has formed a strategic alliance in some instances with the Muslims, especially in the issue of abortion, for example. You know, back in 1994, during the Cairo conference, when the United States government tried to impose abortion as a human right on the world community, and the Pope and the Muslims joined up opposing this. Sometimes the Pope, who is after all elderly, but sometimes the Pope, in his exuberance, goes a little further than many of his advisors, especially Cardinal Ratzinger, would wish to. Although, if you read the Pope's writings on this issue, on this subject, he is very, very clear that that Islam is not a comparable religion. Islam is not an alternative to Christianity to salvation. The Romans, but Lutherans would say the same thing, is that, of course, that there are elements of revelation in the Quran as well, especially since much of the Quran is lifted from the Old Testament. But what I'm describing, Harold, is this. I have been describing earlier on simply a very clearly devised strategy of how to confront the Islamic challenge to Europe and elsewhere. And the people that I'm talking to, who are people responding to Ratzinger and others, have theologically of an extremely sound mind, and have no argument with whom I can have no argument, at least on this particular issue. And that is where they are urging us to join them by saying, look, we can only do this together as Christians. Otherwise, we'll be split apart by this. And there they are right. Then let us have our doctrinal arguments between Catholics and Lutherans and Anglicans, what have you, beyond that. But on this particular issue, that we must affirm Christ together, I don't think there shouldn't be any argument, especially since these guys are well prepared. And I tell you, they're like an army. It's fantastic.
Uwe Simonetto, thank you so much for being our guest again on Issues, Etc. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. It's a beautiful setup for what I want to talk about when we come back from this break during Open Lines. I've mentioned it already a couple times here in the course of the broadcast day. Ecclesiastical Darwinism. I'm going to leave you over the break to consider what I might mean by that. I will explain here at length. Another question. If the statistics are true, and there's no reason to believe that they are not, the Roman Catholic Church growing by 10 million people worldwide every year. In America alone, just on Easter night, between 70 and 75,000 adults baptized every Easter. Why aren't we looking to Rome for answers? Why do we always look toward theologically bankrupt evangelicalism for how to grow a church? We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Is there anything wrong with preaching that urges unbelievers to make a decision for Christ? Is there anything wrong with preaching that tries to motivate good works in Christians through the preaching of God's commands? What about preaching that contains neither God's commands nor His promises? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is called God's No and God's Yes, The Proper Distinction Between Law and Gospel. This book will help you recognize the difference between good preaching and bad preaching. To find out more about God's No and God's Yes, visit our Issues, Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Or, to order the book, call Concordia Publishing House, weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues, Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. High school graduates are ill-equipped to enter the workplace or higher education. That's the bad news from a new study that appears to place blame squarely on the education establishment. Keith Peters has the story from Washington.
According to the American Diploma Project, the American high school diploma only indicates a certificate of attendance. And while some parents and their children believe they're equipped, employers and post-secondary institutions say otherwise. Ohio Governor Bob Taft says there's a problem in his state.
Among high school graduates enrolling directly in college, 19% need remedial help in English, and 29% need remedial help in math. Ohio spends over $20 million per year on remedial education for recent high school graduates.
Taft calls that an inefficient way to go about preparing young people for success. Business leaders tell him that high school graduates lack the skills needed to become highly productive workers. The American Diploma Project calls for state benchmarks determining specific English and math skills that high school graduates need to be successful. Chester Finn of the Fordham Foundation.
The English and math that you need to know to succeed in Indiana and the English and math that you need to succeed in Nevada are not very different from each other.
Katie Haycock of the Education Trust says establishing standards will involve a change in the education establishment.
We have to get out of this business of saying we need to educate some kids for college and some kids for work, acknowledge that the two now demand essentially the same thing, and educate all kids both for college and for work.
She says it's time to make that high school diploma count. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
One of the benchmarks recommended in the study would require Algebra 1, Algebra 2, and Geometry rather than just 3 years of math. They also ask that all students be held to the same English and math standards regardless of the school they attend. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org.
Issues Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes, the Proper Distinction Between Law and Gospel. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. God's No and God's Yes, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Okay, it's open lines for the next hour. We're going to lap over the top of the hour from 5 to 5.30. We'll also be doing open lines. And then at 5.30 or thereabouts, we'll be joined by Josh Baker, policy analyst for the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy based in Washington, D.C. There are two news items that we need to discuss with him. First of all, today, through a spokesman, President George W. Bush announced that he would be willing to endorse a federal marriage amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The wording has not been decided. Of course, there's lots of proposals out there, but he made it clear that he would be willing to endorse this. And the second issue that we'll deal with when we talk with Josh Baker is President Bush's marriage initiative, $1.5 billion for the encouragement through various avenues of marriage. That's coming up in the very last half hour of Issues, Etc. Now, it's open lines for the next hour. Anything you'd like to call in and talk about, any question or comment you may have, something based upon something we were talking about earlier or earlier in the week, or if you just have a wild hair from some time back, feel free. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If you've ever listened to Open Lines, Issues, Etc., it's pretty clear you guys have free rein to set the agenda. I always come prepared. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and vamp for 55 minutes, but feel free to change the subject. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We just got done talking with Uwe Simonetto. One of the stories that he brought to us was of the colossal, it can only be described as gargantuan, colossal, titanic growth of a church body that never gets listed among megachurches. You remember when we did that thing on megachurches that Fox News had talked about? And it was very clear how they defined megachurches. Non-Roman Catholic churches with memberships upward of 2,000. Not memberships, actually. Weekly attendance upward of 2,000 people. Non-Roman Catholic. Why? Why? Why, oh, why would we leave the Roman Catholic churches out of our measurement of megachurches? There's a reason, folks. Because if we didn't leave them out, the rest of us would all look like, well, we'd need a microscope to look at the rest of us, to tell you the truth. 1.1 billion Catholics worldwide. They grow by 10 million a year, every year, in the United States alone, only on Easter, just on Easter evening, between 70 and 75,000 adults baptized every year. That's just on Easter. That's just in the United States. That's why they don't define a megachurch as having anything to do with Roman Catholic churches, because we all look pretty small compared to that, to tell you the truth. The only way we get to say we're big is if we're in a very small pond. Okay, there are 1.1 billion Roman Catholics worldwide. That makes it the largest Christian denomination in the world, undisputably. By a distant second, there are about 554 million Pentecostals. There are 218 million Eastern Orthodox. The Anglicans, which are still huge, 77 million worldwide. And then the Reformed, the Methodists, the Lutherans, the Baptists. We're just little amoeba. We're just little protozoan floating around in the pond. Although we like to boast that we're megachurches sometimes. It's funny when put in global perspective. Okay. Just take that. We got a church that's big and growing, not in terms of percentage, but in terms of raw numbers, far beyond anything that the church growth movement ever been able to produce, that American Protestantism has ever been able to experience. Unbelievable when you look at the numbers. They're mind-boggling. One-third of the population of the United States, one-third of the population of the United States, in terms of numbers, is how much they're growing, the Roman Catholic Church, every year. I'm sorry, not one-third. I was mistaken. 1/30. Still a lot of people. 10 million people is nothing to sneeze at. Okay. I ask the question then. Why is it when the conventional wisdom in the church today is to say, well, look, these non-Roman Catholic Protestant churches that are having more than 2,000 people in worship every Sunday are the churches we ought to be watching to see how the rest of us ought to be doing it. Why are we ignoring the Roman Catholics? Why aren't we looking to Rome for answers when it comes to what is commonly called growing churches? Why not? Why are they being ignored? Why are Roman Catholic churches aced out of anything when they define megachurches? I mean, if we really believe that the unassailable, infallible credential of authority in the church is that you have a big church. You've got a big church. You're worth listening to by default, de facto. I mean, that is the one unassailable credential of authority. If you got a big church, you must know what you're doing. Why aren't we listening to the biggest of all? Why aren't we looking to the biggest of all? Why are our eyes not turned and our ears open to what they're doing, this colossus that makes the rest of us look like Lilliputians? I'd like your answer to that question. I'd like your answer to that question, especially if you're an advocate of church growth. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. Also, this goes along with it, but I don't know if... Yeah, it goes along with it beautifully. Ecclesiastical Darwinism. Driving along today, coming back from a chapel at Metro East Lutheran High School. Great group of kids and teachers up there at Metro East. I'm just tootling down the highway on my way from there to someplace else, and I'm thinking, as I often do when I'm driving. And this term occurred to me, ecclesiastical Darwinism. Ecclesiastical Darwinism. What does it mean? Now, rather than make you guess, I'll go ahead and explain myself. This is a thought that's actually entered my mind before, and then I lost it for about 2 months. About 3 weeks ago, I said to myself, you know, last week I had a brilliant idea, but I have forgotten what it is. Have you ever had that happen to you? You have a brilliant idea. You know, you remember that you had a brilliant idea, and you said to yourself, boy, I should write this one down. And by the time the day is done, you've forgotten, maybe it wasn't so brilliant after all, but you've forgotten what it was. It came back to me. Ecclesiastical Darwinism. Well, just take it apart. I mean, laying aside for the moment the term ecclesiastical, that just refers to the church. Churchly Darwinism, church Darwinism, whatever you want to call it. Classical Darwinism, when it comes to the origin of life, is a very simple teaching. Now, modern Darwinism, modern evolution, has become far more complex because they've had to prop it up with all sorts of caveats and whereases and wherefores. But classical Darwinism, as Darwin conceived of it, was just a simple mechanism by which he believed life not only came into being, its origins, but also by which life continued, survived. Ah, there's the word, survival of the fittest. It's the way we all learned in grade school what Darwinism or what evolution was all about. Survival of the fittest. The fittest survive, the unfit, they don't. And in the biological world, what Darwinism posits is that an organism, whatever it may be, let's just say for the sake of argument, the ones that Darwin was concerned with, birds. If I'm not mistaken, it was some kind of finch. Isolated on an island in the middle of the ocean, he observed that these finches all had developed different beak shapes, different wing lengths, different body shapes, different habits, different nesting patterns, even different mating patterns, all to accommodate their various environment. They had changed to survive. Those that fed on nectar had elongated beaks for reaching into flowers. Those that fed on nuts had short beaks for being able to break through the hull of the nut or the seed. And he simply concluded, on the basis of what he could extrapolate, that, you know, you got one species of bird that originally somehow accidentally flew off course in a hurricane and ended up on this isolated remote island, and maybe a couple moms and dads, and they, after interbreeding, they found their niche in the environment, and the niche determined what they would be like in the future. They changed, they adapted, or they perished. And the reason the ones that we have around today are around today is because they changed, they adapted. They changed to be the fittest, others didn't. They survived to breed another day, and so their genetic code got passed on. Darwin conceived of this in a microcosm, then, of course, posited that this is how everything happens. Survival of the fittest. Change or die. Change, adapt, or die. In its extreme form, ecclesiastical Darwinism is pretty hair-raising stuff. We've talked often about Bishop John Shelby Spong. He has actually written the book called Why Christianity Must Change or Die. He is an ecclesiastical Darwinist in its extreme form, its absolute extreme form. He recently has responded to questions. He's got a new little New Christianity for a New World. I guess it's a website. He's trying to sell books. You can get his essays. You can get his thoughts. And as a little teaser, they send out a Q&A with Bishop John Shelby Spong. And on a weekly basis, he asks, or he answers a question. The question that he answered this week that caught my eye and got me thinking about something like ecclesiastical Darwinism came from Warren in California, who asked this question. Since you say that any God who can be killed should be killed, is it not fair to say that if Christianity can die, it should die, or it must die? Now remember, the imperative that drives Darwinism in its biological form is that those that aren't fit have an obligation to die. They are useless eaters. They are useless consumers of air and food and water. They have an obligation to die. Those that are fit are the only ones who deserve to live. I mean, in a biological sense. So he's asked, oh, Bishop Spong, don't you think that if Christianity can die, it should or even must die? What is Spong's response? My answer is a simple yes. If Christianity can die, then it should die and it will die. If Christianity needs you and me to defend it from real or imagined enemies, it is surely in bad shape. Then he goes on, as he usually does, to opine about what Christianity really is. And he says, in the end, there are no ideas. There's no lasting truth. There's no one doctrine that survives. Christianity has survived to this day, says John Shelby Spong, because it has always changed and always adapted. It's always adopted new and strange teachings like the virgin birth and things like that in order to survive. But sooner or later, those adaptations will become obsolete and they'll need to adopt something new. This is ecclesiastical Darwinism in its extreme form. But there's a less extreme form of ecclesiastical Darwinism. I'll tell you about that in just a moment. Maybe you're... Oh, you want me to tell you now? You're anxious to hear it now? Where is ecclesiastical Darwinism? The Spongs are easy to spot. You can see a Spong coming. The smoke from his fire can be seen for miles away. But ecclesiastical Darwinism has, and Spong's theology, if you can even call it a theology, has a very close kissing cousin. In fact, I would say it's the same mentality, survival of the fittest. Spong says that if Christianity in general is not fit, well, he didn't believe it is, but he says if it can die, it should die. And he thinks it can, and it has to, in order for something new to survive, a new adaptation to continue. Isn't this precisely the mentality of the church growth movement? Survival of the fittest. The church must change or die. How many times have you heard from someone who advocates church growth that the sky is falling, that the church is on the verge of death if it doesn't make a change, and soon? How often have you heard from the mouth of church growth advocates about dying congregations? Well, they're dying. They refuse to change. That's why they're dying. And it even goes so far as, say, Spong's mentality, which is, and they should. They're in our way. They're useless consumers of Christians. They contribute nothing except they just consume Christians and their donations, and they would be better off dying, and we can take their members from them because we have changed and we are destined to survive. Change or die. The imperative becomes change. The rule that runs Darwinism in its biological form is change. And sad to say, a lot of churches have adopted ecclesiastical Darwinism as their new theory. Why has the church survived? Well, it's always changed. It's always changed. That's the only reason it survived. You see, there's no life. There's no origin. There's no creator here at the back of all of this for Darwin. Life does not continue because the creator made it this way for Darwin. And in the same way, the advocate of ecclesiastical Darwinism, the church doesn't survive because Jesus is alive. The church survives only if, as like an organism, it constantly adapts to its environment and changes. And sometimes we're going to have to just get rid of the obsolete things and adopt new things. And the church of tomorrow may look nothing like the church of yesterday. Just like that finch that first blew in the hurricane over to that remote island. It looked like an ordinary finch, but 50, 60, 100 generations later, its offspring look like hummingbirds or something like that. They adapted. They changed. And those that died along the way, they didn't deserve to live. Only the fittest survive. Let's go to the phones. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Sorry to keep all of you waiting. First up, Ray is calling from his car. Ray, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Pastor Todd. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First and foremost, I'd like to comment on the amount of adults that are baptized on Easter Sunday in the Catholic Church. A large percentage of those adults are other Protestants and non-Christians who are marrying somebody who is Catholic. Which would formulate a question in my mind, is that true conversion? And that's just my comment on that. And my question to you is about the homosexual agenda. The homosexuals, in my opinion, represent the vocal minority. And when are we, as the priesthood of all believers, the silent majority, going to stand up and say, this isn't happening? And I'll sign off and I'll let you comment on that. Thank you.
Ray, thank you, and thank you very much. Two good questions, and thank you for being so patient. And the rest of you who are still being patient. Is it a true conversion when, say, someone who's marrying into a Catholic family? I don't know that the Catholics rebaptize people. I mean, I think they recognize as valid the baptisms of virtually every Christian denomination. If you're a Mormon, I think they have an official policy that was put out about 2 years ago, if my memory serves me. The Pope said, if you're a Mormon, you're baptized as a Mormon, we're going to rebaptize you. Too bad. We're going to rebaptize you if you become a Christian. But I don't think they rebaptize other Christians. Now, it's a bigger question, though. How many people who are coming in, that 10 million worldwide every year, are Christians from other denominations? Probably a good number of them. I would ask also how many of those coming into the Protestant megachurch movement are already Christians of other denominations? 75%. 75%. According to William Chadwick in his book, Stealing Sheep, and he's a church growth advocate, he just wants them to be honest. He says, we're stealing sheep. We claim that this is growth of the church. Church hasn't grown according to the statistics. And remember, he's not measuring Roman Catholics. He says, what we're just doing is moving people from smaller churches to bigger churches, and we're calling it the growth of the church. The other thing about the silent majority on the issue of homosexual marriage, well, it depends on what you mean by standing up and saying this. I think it's happening right now. In Ohio, they just signed their law that would define marriage as a man and a woman. They became the 38th state. That's enough states to pass a constitutional amendment. So I think the silent majority, not only the priesthood of all believers, but many non-Christians too. You know, I don't think Muslims are real fond of gay marriage either, or Mormons, or Orthodox Jews, or for that matter, probably a lot of people who are none of the above. So I think people are standing up and saying no more. The question is, how do you do it best? Maybe the ballot box is the best place to do it. And if they give us the opportunity to vote on it, that's all we want, is the opportunity to vote on it. Back to the phones. Will is calling from St. Louis. Hi, Will. Will, welcome to Issues, Etc. Let's talk with Anne. She's calling from St. Louis as well. Anne, welcome. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I've got a question for you.
Sure.
I'm not sure if I heard this right yesterday, but it was on either on your radio station, one of the news blurbs, or it was on one of the other Christian news stations in the St. Louis area, and it said that there were recent statistics that there were over either 13,000 or 1,300 cases of Roman Catholic clergy that had been accused in molestation cases that had been covered up.
You mean nationwide?
Yeah. Did you hear anything about that yesterday?
I can't say I've heard the account, although the 1,300 seems a figure too low. I mean, having covered this story for the last 2.5 years, we're now going on 2 solid years in February here since it broke in 2002, February, the larger number wouldn't surprise me at all.
But, you know, what the amazing thing to me about it was that they were saying that it was these were recently uncovered cases that had never been reported. And you didn't hear anything about that?
No, I'm sorry I haven't. I will try and look into it, though.
Okay.
And thank you. Thank you. And in spite of the fact that they have had, here it is, intrepid producers, sometimes they pay off. Oh, it's a smaller number. The AP says, this is Associated Press. Associated Press counts more than 1,300 priests accused of abuse since 1950. So we're not talking about recent cases. We're talking about going back to 1950. An Associated Press review has found that more than 1,300 Roman Catholic clergy members have been accused of molesting minors since 1950. That's according to a local diocese nationwide contacted by the AP. More than half of all the dioceses haven't released any numbers, including ones facing hundreds of allegations like Boston and Los Angeles. The church will be laying out a nationwide accounting of all abuse claims and costs later this month in a bid to recapture public trust. Determining how many of the accused priests are actually guilty is difficult, since much of the alleged abuse happened decades ago. Many cases weren't investigated by police, and some of the accused priests have died. There's the story. Harold from St. Charles, welcome. We've only got a few minutes here, just a minute or so.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I didn't get to hear everything that Uwe said. I'd just love to hear him on the radio, but you know about the Roman Catholic growth. I don't think he touched upon what's happening down in the Latin American countries, from Mexico south, where you just hear that the Pentecostals are just reaping a big harvest, and even the Lutheran churches down there are gaining in large numbers. And it just seems like one of the big things that attracts people is the authority that the Roman Church has in it. But it's got its big problems that discourage its own people. And you know that move there that they had there to try to bring back the lapsed Catholics. I've been asking that. I think I've asked on the program, and you've had a Roman Catholic on there, and no satisfactory answer. I think some of this about the pedophilia, and that's really discouraged a lot of them.
Harold, thank you for the call. Oh, my goodness. Oh, there's another thing, too. And of course, there's been growth in other churches. I'm not denying that. I'm just asking the bigger question, which is, if the trend is true, that we're talking about a church that grows by 10 million worldwide every year, 1.1 billion members worldwide, why do the advocates of church growth not look to Rome when they're looking around saying, well, the big churches seem to have all the answers, and they don't look at the biggest? They don't. In fact, by comparison to the biggest, they're looking at kind of the middle of the pack. Why do they look to the evangelical churches and not to the Roman churches? I'd like your answer to that question, especially if you're an advocate of church growth. When we come back, also from Uwe's conversation, the liturgy and preaching seems to be attracting men back. I'll have more to say on that after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.